For Monday, March 23rd, welcome everybody. Happy Monday. I would like to open a public hearing on House Bills 3196 and House Bill 3483. Erin, could you explain the measures?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3196 prohibits members of Legislative Assembly from participating in discussion or debate if actual conflict of interest exists, prohibits member from voting on issue when actual conflict of interest exists unless vote is necessary to establish quorum, and 3483 adds secular organizations and parties to marriage to list of persons and entities authorized to solemnize marriages. You have a dash one amendment. It also adds legislators or former members of the legislature to list of individuals who may solemnize marriages. Both of these measures, Madam Chair, have no revenue impact, and there has not been a statement of fiscal impact issued on either of them yet.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenock, House District 33, and I'm delighted to be here to comment on both these bills. Let me start with House Bill 3483. House Bill 3483 has to do with the solemnization. Isn't that a great word? The solemnization of marriages. A couple wants to get married. They go down and get a marriage license. They wait a few days, then they go off and get married. And then somebody has to certify, solemnize that marriage. And right now it can only be a member of the clergy or a judge or the county clerk. And in a state where 43% of the population reports that they're not religious, this turns into both a financial and a logistical problem for a couple. Anybody can come and perform the marriage, but to get it solemnized, they then have to go to a judge or to a county clerk. And in that case, pay something like $120 to get their marriage solemnized. The secularist group brought this bill to me and proposed in the bill that the member of a secular group that had the same kind of philosophical basis for life should be included along with a religious group. That made sense to me, but I added to a piece myself that said, well, why can't the married couple solemnize their marriage themselves? Somebody will officiate of their choice, and this allows them to themselves solemnize their own marriage and file it. There's an amendment to it brought to me by Representative Hayden. Representative Hayden, the senior, that also proposes for your consideration in this bill, and I have no problem with it, the ability of members of the legislature or retired members of the legislature to solemnize marriage. Now, I'm sure nobody will want Representative Gilliam to do that, but other than that, it would be.
Wow.
I was going for this.
He's been picking on me with his cane today, so I had to get back.
Hey, you're not going to get any argument from this committee.
That's great.
That seems to me a reasonable thing. And in fact, one time, when some friends of mine were going to get married, I checked to see whether a member of the legislature could solemnize marriages, even though I didn't know what that term was, and it turned out not, and that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing. So I would ask you to take seriously this bill and to move it. I think it improves the statutes in a way that's very significant. And you have your... you have, I think, in OLIS, the report on the question, are you religious, in which 43% of Oregonians said no, only surpassed by, you know, like Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. We're sort of like that. Let me also comment, if I may, on House Bill 3196. We're in an era, you may have noticed this, we're in an era where the question of government ethics is becoming very much to the forefront. I have been troubled for some time, as several of you know, with the question that when somebody has an actual conflict of interest, not a potential conflict, but an actual conflict, a very narrow case of which I can remember about one happening in my career here, or maybe two, a very specific narrow conflict of interest where their own pecuniary well-being is affected either positively or negatively by a bill, not only is that person allowed to vote on that measure and take part in the debate, but is required to vote on that bill or take part in that voting. That seems to me to be a very, very bad idea. I'm recommending to you here, I propose a statutory fix in this, even though I know it is of questionable constitutionality. But the reason that I put this fix in is to give you the opportunity as a committee to debate the issue, think about the issue, and then change the House rules in a way that makes sense, rather than having, I don't think it needs a statutory fix, and it really wasn't my intention to get you to work this bill. But I hope you'll take the opportunity of having this bill before you to look very carefully at the House rules and to see whether whether the kinds of proposals in the bill or something like that could be put into the House rules, and one would hope the Senate rules as well, but into the House rules to allow people not to vote when they have a direct pecuniary conflict with the bill. I'm going to be faced with a problem if we pass a bill to increase the salaries of circuit court judges in this state. My son is a circuit court judge, and it puts me in a very awkward place, even though it would not fall under the strict interpretation in this bill because he's a member of a class of about 180 people. So by our House rules, that would not be a direct conflict of interest. It would be a professional. It still has made me very uncomfortable to think about having to vote on this bill, and if I can find a way not to, I won't if we pass it, because it could amount to putting an extra $250,000 as a result of that bill in my son's pocket as a result of his career as a judge. That feels very awkward to do, and it made real this bill. So I'm not asking you to work this bill, but what I'm begging you is to take a look at the House rules and see if we can't find a way to improve on that situation.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Does any comments or questions on either of these two bills, either 3483 about the solemnization of marriage, or House Bill 3196 about conflicts of interest? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The second one is thorny, and I'll have to think about it, but I wanted to comment on the first bill. I proposed a bill in either 2003 or 2005, I don't recall which, in which I suggested amending the law of solemnization of marriage to allow members of the legislature to be the solemnizer. The bill got a hearing because I asked for it, and that was as far as it went. The interesting thing about that as it pertains to today is, given the reaction of the committee just to your suggestion and your own reaction to the proposed amendment, I think the world has changed a lot in 10 years or 12 years since then, and that this isn't such a strange idea anymore. I will note that in the state of California, it is possible for virtually anyone to get a one-time a license to solemnize one marriage, one particular marriage, under some circumstances. That's another possible way of dealing with some of these issues, and I understand that that works fairly well. I would note that the issue that Representative Greenlick raises, I think, is a is an important one. The particular marriage that was of interest to me at the time was one involving two of my legislative assistants who had decided to marry each other and wanted me to solemnize the marriage. As it turned out, I wasn't able to do that, but because the way our statute is written, the best man was able to get himself declared a minister of a church, I didn't go into the details of which one, and signed the marriage certificate. But I actually read the service and conducted the marriage ceremony, because the way the statute's written, that's possible to do that, even though you're not the solemnizer. So it's interesting to me that you stick around here long enough and all these ideas come back and are up for review, and I certainly concur with Representative Greenlick's comments.
Madam Chair,
oh, and by the way, they're still married.
Oh, well.
You did a good job.
Yes.
It was a week ago.
One of the things that happened in the past generation and my generation is there were available on the web mail order Doctor of Divinity degrees that people could get and then use that.
But I didn't ask, but I think that's exactly what happened in this case.
Seems better to do it this way.
Any other questions or comments on either of these bills? Yes, Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenlick, in Section 1 of the bill, House Bill 3483, yep. You're comparing secular organizations with methods and values that play in the same role in the members' lives as the role that methods and values of religious congregations or organizations play in the lives of members, et cetera, et cetera. You reference a statute. I'm looking in that. And I'm curious, would you be willing to exclude any reference in there to religious congregations and organizations? I mean, because if in the end, here's, I guess, my point and why I'm asking, why have the comparison at all? It invites a certain amount of scrutiny of one's legitimate interest in the secular organization and, of course, invokes perhaps those who do consider themselves religious to defend the role that religion plays in their lives. It just seems to want to invite a debate that perhaps is not needed.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, this language came from the organization themselves. I think they probably have their own concerns to deal with. I would have no problem taking out the second part of that paragraph that should be talking about secular. This is talking about item E on line 17 in the bill, which says secular organizations with, it defines a secular organization when in fact you could end that. I mean, we could make that, I think, a way that simply talks about espousing a certain kind of values without having to compare it to a religious organization. And I'd be quite happy to rewrite that in the way that made that happen. So, I definitely see your point.
Yeah, thank Representative you. Greenlick, so we would, you'd be willing to work on an amendment that would talk about the rights granted to a certain to certain people and not as comparison to other people, right?
Yeah.
I think that gets everybody where they want to be.
I think it would say something like secular organizations, methods and values that define a way a person would live their life, something off the cuff that doesn't.
I suppose, let's say for an example, it's Sierra Club. And so an intern working a summer in Sierra Club perhaps couldn't solemnize a marriage ceremony, but the executive director of watersheds could, or something. So I suppose that's why there is some distinction as to the association with the secular. I just think that if we're broadening those who can solemnize a marriage to what is a more modern view, then why have any reference at all to any religious organization? It seems what we're... And in that regard, I'm not sure why E couldn't say secular organizations in their, you know, or officers or directors of secular organizations that people are associated with.
And then don't forget F.
I think you're going to have a witness from the secular humanists. I think it would be useful to take it up with them. But I think we can work out a way to talk about this being more than the Sierra Club, but less than having to compare it in any way with religious organizations.
And also we'll consider Representative Hayden's amendments. Did somebody else have?
I did, but let's move on.
Okay. I'm going to call up some other people to testify. Thank you very much, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you for hearing these bills.
With that, I'm going to close the hearing on 3196 and keep going with House Bill 3483. There were three people: Anthony Behrens, Kimberly McCullough, and Brian Harvey. Is it Harvey? Come on up. Why don't you start and just identify yourself for the record, and thank you.
All right, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd like to just provide some comments in support of House Bill 3483, but also mention that Representative McClain brought up some options. I think that we would also support options like what he described or something else that went to that effect. Essentially, Oregon... our Oregon Constitution, in particular Article 1, Sections 2, 3, and 20, they demand that that the Oregon legislature and that our laws treat secular organizations and religious organizations equally. The founders of Oregon were particularly concerned about the beliefs of non-believers, about respecting the rights of non-believers, agnostics, atheists, and religious people. And so... the fact that the way that the statutes are written, it essentially means that if a person is religious and they belong to a church and they want to get solemnized by their religious advisor, then they can have the marriage of their choice. But if a person doesn't belong to a church, say they're they have some spiritual beliefs that then and they don't go to a church, or they have a spiritual advisor that they look up to, that they go get advice from, but that doesn't belong to a church, or if they're an atheist or a person who just chooses to have a secular wedding, but they want to get married by somebody that they look up to, maybe that person has provided some particular support of their relationship. They look to them for guidance. They're a mentor. A lot of times people want to get married by their parent or by, you know, someone who's just really been there for them. In that circumstance, those people can have their wedding officiated by that person, but then it's not actually, that ceremony doesn't actually, under Oregon law, solemnize the marriage. So then they have to go get a different person to marry them or to solemnize it. And so they have a different wedding than the person who goes to a church, right? That person that goes to the church gets to have the wedding that they want, solemnized by the person they want, that actually, under Oregon law, makes it official, and that other person doesn't. So there was some mention of people getting temporary authority. The Universal Life Church is the main organization that people get that authority from. I happen to know quite a few people who have gotten their ministerial status from the Universal Life Church in order to solemnize marriages. The interesting thing about that, though, is that the Universal Life Church has a certain set of beliefs, and they are a church. And so a person who gets authority from them may not share those beliefs, right? Or they may not want to belong to a church, but they're getting their ministerial authority from that church in order to do that. So, and that under Oregon law is a valid solemnization. So essentially changing the law would bring the law actually into line with what people are actually doing, but it would treat things equally as far as like religion and non-religious organizations. So whether it be through this specific wording of the statute or something else, the ACLU would support that change.
Good afternoon. My name is Anthony Behrens. I guess a quick disclaimer, I'm here on my own behalf, not of that of my employer. Just some quick background about myself. I was a circuit court judge pro tem here in Marion County for a couple years. In that capacity, I began officiating weddings because that's what judges do. It turns out I'm kind of good at it, and I've kept doing it ever since. And I happen to be the highest and most rated wedding officiant in Oregon. So I have actually brought a couple bills. One got a hearing in this very committee last full session. And my idea was similar to Representative Greenlake's in attempting to expand the number of civil wedding officiants. My idea was to allow for former judicial officers. One of the categories now is judicial officer can solemnize a wedding. So I fully support Representative Greenlake's bill in that in his attempts to sort of broaden the secular aspects of it. What I'm very concerned about section 1, subsection 2G. I happened to just come across this bill actually by accident. I was cleaning out my inbox, and I just happened to look fondly on your agenda, because I remember I was here one time, and I happened to see this bill. And my concern is that this would actually decimate a number of small businesses like mine if you allow the couple to solemnize their own wedding. There's really no need for them to hire a wedding officiant to officiate their wedding, because people don't do a bifurcated sort of wedding. They hire the person they want to do the wedding to solemnize the wedding. Very rarely, I would say, two times in 2,000 weddings have I had anyone do that sort of bifurcated system where they actually just have me solemnize it and someone else actually perform the wedding. So that doesn't really happen. And my concern is that you don't have the wedding officiants that do this here to sort of weigh in on this. There are a lot of them. They pay taxes. They're small businesses. They advertise. They build websites. So there is a revenue impact here. That would be my main concern. And I think if you were going to go that route, and certainly your call, I would hope you would have a broader discussion. But I think if you sort of look at the word itself, solemnization, it contains the word solemn, and if people are doing it themselves, I think that sort of takes away from that imprimatur of authority, that this is an important decision that you're making, and that you know you might want to think about it a little bit first. I mean, one of the things, you know, a popular phrase in a ceremony is marriage is a relationship that is not to be entered into lightly, and it's something to think about. And I think if you know you can solemnize your own wedding, there's really it becomes a little bit less sort of important. And maybe the And if you were going to go that route, I mean, you might even think about if you're going to still require someone to get a license to get married, they could simply, when they obtain the license, that could be the point of marriage. I mean, that's really, there's just sort of no other reason to have someone else solemnize it if you're gonna go the self-solemnizing route. That's kind of what I would say. But I guess I would hope that you would maybe have a broader conversation. There's no real officiant lobby that I'm aware of, but I'm sure I can get the word out. And then I guess the only other thing is I would support the amendment to include legislators, and I would actually ask that you consider former judicial officers as well.
So just to understand, there's part of the bill that you do like and part that you don't. So if you had to put that into three bullet points, what would that be?
As to why I don't?
No, as to what exactly.
Oh. So the only thing I don't like is Section 1, Subsection 2G, because, again, I think it impacts a lot of small businesses, and I don't think that that's really being taken into account.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Sure, that'd be great. And then just identify yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Brian Harvey, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for hearing my testimony today. I'm here on behalf of the Center for Inquiry, CFI, a national nonprofit organization for whose Portland branch I currently serve as executive director. And the Portland branch serves the entire Pacific Northwest region. And I'm here on behalf of the other thousands of Oregonians who fall outside my membership, who also live, as my members do, full, ethical, and meaningful lives without any supernatural or religious beliefs. CFI promotes ethical living without belief in a deity, and CFI maintains, among other things, that it is possible to have strong ethical values based on critical reason and scientific inquiry rather than just on theism and faith. CFI's methods and values, and you guys have gotten into this a little bit, but they play the same role in our members' lives that religious methods and values play in the lives of adherents. As such, CFI maintains a secular celebrant program so that for our members, occasions such as weddings and funerals can be marked by expressions and ceremonies appropriate to our beliefs. Several members of the Portland branch have graduated from this program and are certified by CFI as secular celebrants. The Oregon Revised Statute Section 106.120 currently specifies who may solemnize a marriage in Oregon, that is, perform the final steps that unite two persons who hold marriage licenses. Presently, aside from certain government employees, Oregon law only allows marriages to be solemnized by religious congregations and their clergy. Solemnization by a government employee, and I apologize I came in a little late, I don't know if this has been, if I'm retreading something here, but solemnization by, say, a judge or a county clerk does come with an additional $105 solemnization fee, which is separate from the fee for a marriage license. Last summer, a statute in Indiana, which barred secular organizations from solemnizing marriages through provisions that are identical to Oregon's current statute, was struck down by the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in a unanimous decision on the grounds that it violated the First and 14th Amendments to our federal constitution. The state of Indiana at the time had asked that secular organizations call their secular humanism a religion, or that they gain additional, quote, clergy credentials from an online outfit such as the Universal Life Church, which was mentioned a moment ago, which ordains anyone with a credit card in mere minutes on its website. The Seventh Circuit rejected the state of Indiana's reasonings, pointing out that the plaintiffs, quote, the plaintiffs are unwilling to pretend to be something they are not or to pretend to believe something they do not. They are shut out as long as they are sincere in following an ethical system that does not worship any god, adopt any theology, or accept a religious label, end quote. The state of Indiana had also noted that a secular celebrant could still officiate an extra-legal wedding ceremony, as was mentioned, for a couple, which the not-yet-married couple could follow up with a trip to the local courthouse to have a judge or a county clerk perform a legally effective solemnization. As I mentioned, in Oregon, this would cost an additional $105. The court had this to say: Lutherans can solemnize their marriage in public ceremonies conducted by people who share their fundamental beliefs, Humanists can't. Humanists' ability to carry out a sham ceremony with the real business done in a back office does not address the injury of which plaintiffs complain. And while our laws often provide, rightfully so, for religious accommodations, the Seventh Circuit also pointed out that, quote, an accommodation cannot treat religions favorably when secular groups are identical with respect to the attribute selected for that attribution. Going on to say that the Supreme Court has also forbidden distinctions between religious and secular beliefs that hold the same place in adherents' lives. And I want to be very, very clear that both myself and my organization have absolute, full, and total, and complete respect for people of faith and for the role that that plays in those people's lives. What we're asking is not to take anything away from that, but simply to be granted equal access to our government and to the institution of marriage. And I know that as I was listening, there were some concerns with the current wording that about the fact that it compares secular organizations' beliefs to how they play similar roles in our members' lives, for example, as religious beliefs do in adherents' lives. One potential fix for that might be changing the wording so that it says, you know, a secular organization that espouses a worldview or has a coherent life stance or something like that, so that some concerns people might have about the model train society solemnizing marriages or something could be avoided. So it's not just any secular organization, right? Because at that point it would be, I guess, any organization. But organizations that one way or another do espouse a worldview and play that role in people's lives. So that is the end of my testimony, and thank you again very much for hearing me today. Any questions? Sorry.
Comments, questions? Yes, Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It occurs to me that there's probably a better reason to be concerned about subparagraph G, and that has to do with fraud and record keeping. As I've been looking through these statutes, the Chapter 106, it appears as though these statutes are not particularly onerous to deal with, except they do require a religious leader or somebody recognized as an official. Other than that, they're pretty simple. But they do require that the evidence of the marriage be reflected in a license, which is later filed with the clerk, having been signed by the right people. And it does occur to me that we need to think carefully about marriages solemnized by the marrying couple because of the potential for fraud. That would be an issue of that. I don't know what my view is personally about that, but I think it's worth a consideration.
And Representative Barnhart, I think it makes a very good point. Vice Chair Gilliam and myself have worked for the past 5 years on an elder abuse prevention work group, and we see many times where people who may not be cognitively able to make clear choices are forced into situations and allowing the parties themselves to be the celebrant. I think you've brought up some very good points as to why that may not be the best choice, having that third party. So I think it would be a good idea. I think that there are some great ideas for amendments to get this to a place where we can consider it, and I want to thank you all for your testimony and for coming here today. And I had no idea about your background doing weddings. I mean, that's fantastic.
Can I just add yes. one thing, and I apologize, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. The fee actually for a county clerk or a judge inside the courthouse is $25. If a judge does it outside of the courthouse, he can charge $100 plus mileage. But that is one thing, the $25. I don't know how much revenue courts make off that. They do a fair number of weddings, but that's a potential impact.
Yes. Fair. And one question, Vice Chair Gilliam.
Please, go ahead,
well,
Dr. Barnes.
Simply a couple of comments. The situation that the chair refers to presents a situation of avoidable marriage under 106.030 when either party to a marriage is incapable of making such a contract or consenting thereto for want of age or sufficient understanding, or when the consent of either party is obtained by force or fraud, such marriage shall be void. So that issue, at least on the face of it, is taken care of. The other issue, I think, of interest in this area, or already dealt with in our statute, is the one where the regularizing rules may not have been exactly followed, and that statute basically says that a marriage that was conducted is not void, nor shall the validity thereof be affected on account of the want of power of the or authority of such person. If the person was acting in the capacity, in other words, the people thought that he or she had that authority, and the marriage was consummated with the belief on the part of the persons of the marriage or either of them that they had been lawfully joined in marriage. So even if the person who is the solemnizer is a fraud, if everything else is up to snuff and the marriage certificates or licenses filed and all of that, that marriage is still valid in Oregon law currently. So it's an interesting set of rules we have already in place.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick question for our committee administrator. If we do this, have another hearing on this, is it possible or convenient, maybe you already know the answer to this, to get some background on the statute around the original solemnizing of the requirement to?
Madam Chair, sure. Vice Chair Gilliam, I would be happy to do that research for you and for the committee members as a whole.
And you're going to think I'm kidding about this other part, but on the record, we have so many pronunciations. Solemn keeps the N silent. Does that, when you lengthen the word,
no.
Does the N, is the N pronounced solemnizing?
Is.
Very strange. Last question for you, Judge Barrett.
The question or the presenter?
I defer to you, academic doctor. Judge, just a quick question. Do you promise not to take this committee lightly? Quickly, two words.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Gilliam, do I promise? I do.
I don't think he was getting it at first.
He figured it out.
That's what he was going for. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
You so
you're
much.
Welcome here anytime.
Okay. With that, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3483 and thank everybody for coming. That was wonderful. With this, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2208. Erin, could you please describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2208 was originally heard on March 2nd. It is the measure that adds civil code enforcement officers to public officials who may request exemption from required disclosure under public records laws of specific personal information, and the measure defines civil code enforcement officers. You have a -1 amendment. It removes the Department of Public Standards and Training and other state agencies and entities exempt from disclosure, but adds civil code enforcement officers to a list of public employees who may request that any driver or vehicle record kept by the Department of Transportation containing or required to contain eligible employees' residence address contain instead address of public agency employing that employee. ODOT will remove the employee's residence address from its records, and it permits employee to substitute address of public agency employing eligible employee on any driver or vehicle form issued by the Department of Transportation. There is a no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on the amendment, and I believe the Department of Transportation is here if there are any questions regarding the -1 amendment.
Okay, and before I accept a motion, if you remember, this was the bill that Representative McEwen presented, and we were waiting for this amendment, and that's why we didn't move it. But I will accept a motion at this point.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2208.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved to adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2208. Is there discussion? Is there objection? No. Seeing none, the motion passes.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I'd like to move House Bill 2208 with, as amended, to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 2208 to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm having a hard time getting to the point to vote yes on this bill. We certainly have heard of some bad actors, people who did criminal acts. I mean, every story I heard was a criminal act. I think to equate code enforcement with law enforcement is troubling to me. I'm not ready to vote yes on this, but I think most code enforcement folks who, especially those in small towns, are, do their job, and I have not, while it's anecdotal, I just don't see the statewide widespread issue here. We have some really isolated incidences that, are certainly bad. I'm not discounting that. But, law enforcement is a unique situation. They have unique risks, unique training. We have been protecting law enforcement officers' identities and other aspects for a long time in this state. I'm not sure that some incidences in one or two counties, has me prepared to vote for that. I would say to my fellow committee members that, what's next? Every public employee who interacts with the public, I've heard stories about people who wanted, maybe it was hyperbole, but were very upset at the counter person at a DMV office and have threatened them. Do we include DMV folks at the counter? What about parking meters attendants? They certainly have been verbally accosted, sometimes physically. I'm just troubled. I just confess we're about to do a statewide planning, and what I've seen this committee do is take more and more away from the public access, all in the name of protection, and I'm just troubled. I think it's a big step when we open this door. Once we equate someone else to a law enforcement officer, albeit because those stories are decent, I since this is a work session, I think this is the time where we actually debate the bill, we actually talk, and so I'm confessing I'm troubled opening that door because I don't know where it stops, and I can't logically confine it to code enforcement, and so therefore, I guess I'd have to say they probably haven't proven their case to me.
Okay. So is this something you feel like is a place where you just feel like it's camel's nose under the tent or just a bit too far, or with more time it might get you to a different place?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. I don't know. I've been troubled by it because, I have dealt with code enforcement officers in my professional capacity, in my personal capacity. I mean, I had a remodel in my home, and I live in a small county, that's pretty rural, not unlike Coos. And so we all know who the code guys are. Again, I'm troubled that some isolated bad actors who because they harass, they threaten a public, someone doing their job as a matter of public, that was a criminal act. I'm not sure how putting on more restrictions on public disclosure prevents that, certainly in a small county, because we know who they are. And then I'm worried about the fact that, what about parking meter attendants? What about DMV? What about it? Just, you can make that same argument, and I just don't know where it ends. And we're starting to see a real slide this session into non-disclosure, and I probably couldn't get there over time, at least not until I saw evidence that this was a widespread statewide issue. I certainly have great respect for Representative McEwen, and this is in no way dismissive of her effort to provide protection to her constituents.
Okay. Representative Nose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to confess, I never thought about this until this was brought up. I never heard of the job of a code enforcer. I've never had a remodel in my home, this is part of life I've never experienced. And I am not troubled by it, because I do see how they have the potential trying to enforce a law, which law enforcement officers have to do, where they might get treated in a similar manner. And I think it's just, we just can't disclose where these people live and their personal information, if I'm understanding correctly. They can still go to their place of work and show up at a public office and complain or say something, right? It's just that they don't have the right to find out where they live. And with all due respect to Representative Klain, because I think he's bringing up interesting points that I'm struggling with as well, you know, I guess in a small town, at the end of the day, you're still going to probably know where these people live or be able to figure it out pretty easily. But in a big city where I live, these people will have more anonymity, I guess. So for that reason, I think I'm inclined to vote yes.
Okay. Are there any other comments? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I don't think that I can support this today, primarily because of my fault. I was not aware of the amendments, and I want to take a look at those and consider them more before I cast a positive vote for it. I am troubled by the fact that we live in increasingly fierce times, when there are more threats going out to people than ever before, people in public office, public positions. That is something that I want to consider more. But I just don't want to engage in any surprises here today. I'm going to vote against the measure now. I may vote for it later on the floor if it makes it there, but I'm just not ready to do that today.
So we can either move forward with this and give people an opportunity to find out information before it comes to the floor, or my vice chair could withdraw the motion. What would be your preference?
I would first of all say,
and to be scheduled at a later date, but if
Madam
people
Chair.
Feel like they need more time, I'm happy to accommodate that.
Then in the interest of brevity, that's a generous offer, and I will withdraw my motion so that we can get to a place of better understanding before we vote.
And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2208 and open up a public hearing on HJM 12 and HJR 28. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it permissible that I just stay right here?
At your pleasure.
All right. Thank you very much. For the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass, Cave Junction. HJM 12 is not so much a message to Washington, D.C., but really a reminder to ourselves that there is a Tenth Amendment. If I can take a moment to read the Ninth and the Tenth. The Ninth Amendment, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And then the subject of today's Bill, Amendment 10, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states or reserved to the states respectively or to the people. We are blessed to live in a compound republic. We've got the three branches of government that operate, gives us operatively a separation of powers. But we also, as members of a state legislature, act as part of the balancing act when we discuss federalism. Our founders rightly knew that power does have the ability to corrupt, and it does have the ability to grow and exert more power as time goes on. The desire and ability in people to amass power is inherent to being human, I guess. And so what I want to do through this particular measure is simply remind us that there is a Tenth Amendment and what it means. I have no illusions of the impact of this at the congressional level. I've heard described graphically before what Congress thinks of joint memorials coming from state legislatures. But we are a state legislature, and we do have power as such. And so when the Tenth Amendment was ratified, it was obvious to those who were there at that particular time that there were certain powers that the states couldn't have. You know, just an example, coining money or keeping troops in times of peace. It was obvious what states could not do. Under the Tenth Amendment, we could see plainly that the federal government is not given the ability to control manufacturing, agriculture, education, land use, but they do, and we see that they do all the time. So in the wording of HJM 12, just a couple of things here. The Tenth Amendment was designed to limit the scope of federal power, and we know that the government was created by the states to be an agent of the states, and then once again, that's something that we so often forget. And that is that the federal government really is a creation of the states. We all know the arguments that the founders had, strong federal government versus strong states. But we took our oaths to support the Constitution of the United States and the state of Oregon. And to that end, I would like for us to be able to make that statement to the federal government and to ourselves that we really do matter, and that the federal government continues to grow and continues to usurp the authority of the states and the people. And I think that's something that's not even a partisan debate. We can see that happening all the time. In fact, I think there's something going on right now in the Education Committee, and that is that my particular bill, 2835, which allows school districts to opt out of Common Core. I have a feeling that that bill is not going anywhere, but I also have the feeling that most people believe that that's right, that's a good thing. But unfortunately, as we well know, state legislatures get bought off on a regular basis. States get totally bought off by the federal government because we're afraid of losing federal funds, and our fear of losing federal funds every day keeps us from doing the right thing. And I think that's pretty sad. And so the whole intent here, really, of HJM 12 is to remind ourselves once again that we are a state legislature. We are here to defend the state and the people and to claim what is rightfully ours. I don't want to get too far off the subject, but I've got another bill out there that I may or may not get a hearing. But it is a bill, really, that compels us to take a look at the level of federal funding in our state and really do research and take a look for ourselves what would happen to critical services if federal funds were suddenly cut off. You know, again, not a partisan thing. It's just self-protection. So that's what we're attempting to do here in part by this simple measure, HJM 12, and that is just simply remind ourselves of state sovereignty, that we are a state legislature that has powers that we should jealously hold on to, not only for our state, but for our people, and that this is something that we should never forget. Once again, not a controversial thing to me, just I'm a proud member of the state legislature, the state of Oregon, and it's exciting to be here, but we have just conditioned ourselves to believing that in the face of the ever-growing federal leviathan, we can do nothing. And I don't want to go there. I don't want to think that. So that's why I have this before you today. Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Did you have any comments? For some reason, I thought
No, I was. I'll say that Representative Wilson, besides having one of the most, articulate vocabulary, the legislature has one of the best voices in the legislature, and I could listen to this man read the phone book, but I like what he has to say, and I'm supportive of House Joint Memorial 12.
Fantastic. And Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We live in an age of very, very large organizations that operate in worlds that are partly self-managed and partly impinged upon by other forces. The states are pretty small in that world. The federal government is very important for us in many very positive and useful ways. It also is a victim of its own regulatory power. When we talk about these very large organizations, it gets very complicated very quickly, because it is not possible, in my view, to talk about the power of the federal government without, in this day, without talking about the power of large international corporations and the way in which they operate almost zombie-like in pursuit of profit in ways that, without intent and without any evil thought, lead to the downfall of families and individuals around the world. When we talk about these large organizations and try to understand how they impact on the lives of Oregonians and on our own lives, I don't think it's possible to separate out the federal government from all of the other very large, very powerful organizations. And I think from a political theory, the solution to restore power to individuals and to families and to small organizations and the towns and cities and local businesses is going to take a lot more than theorizing about or talking about the federal power and its development. On the other hand, I appreciate the insights, the representative, that you bring to the discussion. I think they're important. I wish they were dispositive, but I think the world's a whole lot more complicated than that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair, if I could just put in a good word for the efficacy of the Constitution. It's either real or it's not real to us. And as one provision in HJM 12 says, resolve that we state our intentions to ensure that all government agencies and their agents and employees operating within the geographic boundaries of Oregon or whose actions have in effect on the inhabitants, lands, or water of Oregon shall operate within the confines of the original intent of the Constitution of the United States. And I think there is an original intent of the Constitution, and it's not as complicated as we make it sound. The job is certainly more complicated by the drift that we have gone toward federalism in time. But yet, I just want to vouch for the words of the Constitution and the words of the Ninth and Tenth Amendments here, as either they're real to us and they count, words matter, or we've lost it. And I don't want to think that.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, thank you so much. And HR 28?
I'm not here to speak on that.
All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on.
Do we?
Yes.
I
don't have anyone here to speak on that. Gilliam is on that. Yeah.
Representative Vice Chair Gilliam, would you care to? We would love to hear from you on HJM 28.
I think you should have to go out there.
HJR 28.
Be allowed to do it.
Yeah, but you're not the chair.
No,
Wilson's on it.
I take these bills in a very solemn. Anyway, I would be happy to be prepared better than I am at this moment at another meeting of the Rules Committee.
Any other comments? Yes. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I hope we can come back and revisit this. I was not planning on talking about it, but it does recognize our issue with administrative rules and the fact that a law can be consigned to an agency going in looking like a racehorse and coming out looking like a donkey because of administrative rules. And so it is my desire, and I think the desire of many people who have signed on to this, to be able to bring administrative rules under a real system of review in time to where we can actually have some kind of control on the intent of the legislature as we passed these bills. And quite often, like I say, it goes in looking like something and comes out entirely different. So I could certainly, with a bit more preparation, be incisive on every aspect of this bill. But that really is the intent of the bill, and it is simply the desire to maintain legislative intent when we pass these bills and then hand them over to the agencies for the rules of implementation.
Thank you. And in your reference to a donkey, did not have anything to do with party affiliation. That was just an example of one thing versus another.
One thing
just
versus
clarification.
Yes, Chair Hoyle, meant nothing by that. Thank you.
Thank you for mentioning the elephant in the room.
Okay, with that,
I think you meant 12.
I will close the public hearings and on HJM 12 and HJR 28, and we will come back to them if there's additional testimony. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3418. Erin, could you describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3418 increases fee the governing body of county may impose for issuing marriage license or registering declaration of domestic partnership. This measure may have a revenue impact, so no statement has been issued, and it may have a fiscal impact and no statement has been issued.
Okay, with that, I would like to call up Janice, and I'm sorry if I don't pronounce your names correctly. Janice Garcia, Alex Kyler, and Jim McCarthy.
The last one is particularly difficult, Madam Chair.
Yes, it is. Yes. The Scottish names will get you every time. Okay, Alex.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I'm here in support of House Bill 3418. As your administrator explained, this is a fee that local governments may charge at the time of marriage, but it's not the marriage fee itself. The marriage fee itself is made up of two components, one of which is earmarked for domestic violence revenue, and the other which remains with the county. This particular law at ORS 107615 is an add-on fee that counties are allowed to charge for a fee of up to $10 currently, and those funds then go to the purposes of conciliation and mediation services that are provided by counties. Janice is a practitioner of that art and will describe to you what it is that those folks do for counties and for the courts. This is a fee that was set in 1977 at $10, and we're here today to seek an increase for that to go up to $25. This is part, we bring this bill because it's part of a two-pronged effort that we've been undertaking actually since 2011 when court revenue fees were restructured. And so those of you who have been in the building for a while will recall there were two bills that really did reform the way fees and fines were assessed at courts and by courts. One of the programs that changed in our world was how funding for mediation and conciliation services were assessed. In the old days, prior to those bills, we charged a fee at the time of divorce. The court charged a fee and the counties added an add-on fee, and that paid for mediation and conciliation programs. After those bills passed, it was switched to an appropriations process, and we've come to the Ways and Means Committee to get funding for all 36 counties' programs for mediation and conciliation. We have, in the past, done some things to try to keep that funding as flexible as possible for counties, and in fact, this session, the three entities before you actually did provide testimony to the Oregon Judicial Department's budget bill, because we are seeking an increase in that appropriation. Unfortunately, when those bills were passed back in 2011, the metro counties and Lane County were sort of stuck into an older rate structure by the nature of the change in those bills. And so, as I said, this is part of a two-part structure, a two-part effort to try to bring these programs back up to whole.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Gilliam and Smith Warner, and members of the committee. My name is Janice Garceau. Nobody gets it right, so that's okay. And I am the program manager for Multnomah County Family Court Services. I'm also the chair and have been for a number of years of the Oregon Association of Family Court Services. So I have colleagues from around the state that mediate and run court-connected mediation programs in many of your communities. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today in support of House Bill 3418. And I apologize for reading from my notes, but I will do that. I'm happy to answer questions, though, or be interrupted if need be. The passage of this bill would allow counties the ability to raise the add-on surcharge to the extent that they deem necessary. It has been the amount that it is currently set for over 30 years, which is a long time. And costs have obviously increased since that time, although we work very hard to keep our costs down. Family mediation services, as Alex described, have been underfunded, especially since the legislative changes in 2011. And Multnomah County Family Court Services in particular has experienced an increase of probably more than 30%. I was conservative in the estimate. We're serving about 500 more cases a year than we served in 2008. So it's a significant workload increase. And we've had a simultaneous reduction in staff capacity because of decreasing revenue over time. This is a pattern that is shared around the state, and some of you may have had opportunity to be in touch with your county programs and become aware of that. But this is not just occurring in Multnomah County. And this is also at a time when unrepresented litigants are increasing to the degree that in some communities about 80% of people are navigating important civil proceedings like divorce and child custody without the benefit of legal counsel. And that makes alternative dispute resolution really critical for those families. So the passage of this bill does allow county leaders to help bridge the widening gap between increasing demand and the ability to fund mediation services. In our county, what this would mean is probably enough revenue to increase staff capacity. So it's not a drop in the bucket for the larger communities, and it does represent some increased revenue also for smaller counties. It would allow us to continue to do what we do every day and to increase our ability to help parents draft arrangements for their children after separation, to protect children from parental conflict by giving them a safe private place to have a conversation, and to allow in court-connected programs, I can vouch for, maybe not other mediation venues, for safer options for survivors of domestic violence who do choose to mediate. Mediation services have benefits not just to the parents and the children that are served. They do help to keep costs down for courts because it's quite expensive for courts and for families to go to court. We divert many, many families, I would say between 40 and 50% from actually getting to a hearing. And hearings are, if anyone's ever had to do one, painful and expensive. And as you know, I'm sure you've heard from OJD, the courts are struggling with the burden of their workload as well. Also, mediation helps keep parents in control of critical private decisions about their children. So mediation is private, it's protected. People can have conversations with a mediator that never get used against them in a courtroom, and that's important. I've already mentioned domestic violence survivors. I believe that in mediation programs with well-trained mediators, survivors of domestic violence sometimes prefer that setting where they have some privacy, some control of the venue, the ability to be separated from the other party, which doesn't happen in a courtroom where often the other party has more control of resources and access to an attorney as a result of that. And finally, there is 30 or more years of research that supports that exposure to divorce conflict and separation conflict is harmful. That's the primary focus of our work. We're trying to keep kids out of the fray, and that is a benefit of mediation. I included some quotes from clients who use our services, but what I want to say that may be more important than that is that I'm not just a program manager. I'm not just someone who crunches the numbers. I mediate with people every day. So I provide services as well as running my program. And just this morning, I had a pair of folks who've been separated for 6 years and sort of bumping along. And they came in with a very unwieldy problem that involved a move, which is very common these days, and they were able to sort it out without having to walk into a courtroom and unload the list of grievances that are not going to serve their child. And it was free, it was private, and it was very important for them. So thank you for considering the testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
And thank you for the work that you do. It's really important, so we appreciate you taking the time to come here. Is any questions? Jim.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, Jim McCauley from Washington County. I don't want to get in too much detail for us. Again, I think both Janice and Alex articulated the same problem that we face as a county in terms of the service delivery, but also from the revenue side, being able to finance that service side of the equation. The reason we're here and the reason we were in front of OJD in terms of their budget proposal was because of the change that took place again back in 2011. We went from essentially a fee-for-service type of program where local governments had the ability to essentially set a fee add-on that matched their level of service. And each county did things a little bit differently. So when you essentially standardized that program and set it up into an appropriations, any county that had a robust level of service delivery essentially didn't get or didn't make out quite as well. And that's essentially where we're at. The program, as it stands right now, 4 years into it, is underfunded. We're probably $30,000 to $40,000 in the hole on this. And the only reason we're only at that level is because we got about a $35,000 grant to help try to at least make up for some of that balance. So part of what's reflected for our support in this bill today comes down to simply having the flexibility to be able to have that add-on fee and try to get us up another notch closer to the actual service level that's needed out there and the actual financial piece to try to match that. I think long term, one thing that would be helpful is a reassessment of what was done in 2011. It's not called for within this bill, but I think it's something that this body should consider. Because again, we're not the only county that was affected. We certainly testified in opposition to both of the bills back in 2011 and shared a number of concerns about what would happen long term. And now, again, several years into actually implementing this stuff, we have physical holes in our budget to deal with a range of the services that we're expected to deliver on the local level. So appreciate your consideration for this today and be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, by Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here, and I do appreciate the work you do. I don't know if you're familiar with the VORP.
Pardon?
Victim Offender Reconciliation Program.
Yeah.
These kinds of services not only are important for the reasons that you said, what difference they make in people's lives, but huge savings. I get that.
one of the dangers when you come and have to go back 30 years to take a look at a fee hike is you also bring up the question, what was the relationship in the original intent here between what I would call a pretty positive, maybe on the surface related, but a positive move by individuals in marriage to put the fee on that for services like you're providing. What justification is there for this is where the money comes from?
You mean in terms of the add-on for the marriage license fee?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, since the 1970s, the divorce rate has been about 50%. So that's a sad fact, and it has actually not wavered significantly since then until very recently when, in fact, the marriage rate is dropping a tiny bit, or the divorce rate is dropping a little bit, which is good news. But it has consistently been true that about half the time people get it right, and they stay together, and about half the time they don't, at least since no-fault divorce became the law of the land. So it's clear that some marriages are going to come apart, and that in many of those marriages there are children involved that have a very critical stake in the outcome of their parents' negotiation about what's going to happen to them. So I believe there's a relationship. It's not a happy one. I don't think anybody walks into a marriage hoping that they're going to benefit from the amount of the fee that goes to mediation, but I think that many of them do, and it's important to keep those services in place.
Follow up, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you for that, and there is some logic to that. I see the connection. I have to say that philosophically, I can't get there. I mean, I see the connection. What almost comes to my mind is an insurance policy. You know, you've got a car, and it's likely you're going to be in an accident. I don't think that works in this case. I am not as informed on county tax policy as I probably should be. Is this, you are completely restricted by state statute to raise or change your fee from 10 without this bill? I assume that's the case.
With this particular fee, yes, it is.
With this particular fee. And I assume there are many other fees that within county government that are equally as restricted by state statute. You can't raise it without a statute change.
I'm
that's probably an unfair
on
question
fees.
For you.
These fellows might know better than I do. But.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Gilliam, it's somewhat dependent on whether you're a home rule county or a general law county. A home rule county does have the ability to pass an ordinance relating to issues of county concern. However, if you're a general law county, you really only can do what the legislature says. So the legislature may say county may set a fee. In this particular case, legislature said county shall set a fee of up to $10, and we're seeking that permission to go up to 25.
Another follow-up, if I might, Madam Chair. Are there, for your counties, are there other options to find revenue, to find appropriations for this kind of thing, or are you so budgeted straitjacket that you can't go laterally to other? Because we are not, this is not new to us, to hear from a very compelling program and not have money for it.
I'll try to take a stab on that. Chair Hoyle, Vice Chair Gillum. I think we have the same budget difficulties that I think this entire building has when you go through your legislative process. If you're short in one area, where do you pull it from some other place? And the only place that we physically have ability to at the local level would be from the general fund. And again, what that means is something else is getting shorted. I think every local government that's out there will make the case that they try to pride themselves and develop a budget package that is capable of sustaining itself over certainly the year, but over time as well. I think the most difficult and the frustrating piece for us is that prior to 11, again, we had flexibility, and that bill set was a mix of other things beyond just marriage licenses. But when you standardize it and essentially come up with a set fee, there wasn't any ability, again, to try to fit a fee for service that fit the physical service side of things. So we're pretty limited in terms of the other budget options or the other revenue sources we have.
Madam Chair, no more questions, but I would say there's a big difference, I suppose, between $25 and I think we heard on the other bill to solemnize $105 or $120. So we've got one, and this is not a reflection on this panel at all, but we've got one group coming in saying, this is awful to charge $120 to newlyweds for solemnizing, and yet we have other fees that we need to raise for people getting married that, in my view, have nothing to do with their marriage. So I certainly don't want to penalize the programs, but I think it's pretty interesting when you compare the two measures today in our committee.
Mr. Kyler.
Thank you. Madam Chair, back in 2011, you know, the idea was to get rid of some of the variability around the state in terms of how fees were charged. And frankly, I think that had this particular fee been really sort of become aware to the drafters of that, those sets of bills, they probably would have repealed this one as well. The irony in that, in repealing the one that was affiliated with divorce, was that I don't think we would have actually faced a three-fifths majority question with that one. We pushed back a little bit on LC upon seeing how this came out of LC with the three-fifths majority. And for your very comments, Vice Chair Gilliam, about that not everybody who pays this fee benefits from it, thus it's a tax. Well, in that case of what we used to have, where when you paid for a divorce, the likelihood was far greater that you were actually going to avail yourself of that service. My sense is that LC would have said that is a fee, and in fact, there was a local provision for raising that involved the presiding court judge making a recommendation to the Board of County Commissioners, and everything would be fine after. So we've really gotten stuck. Like I said, I think Jim did a nice job of indicating this has had some unintended consequences. None of us would really like to be here asking for this. We understand the sort of the controversial nature of adding to the cost of marriage, yet we are here. And
thank you for that comment, and that triggers just a quick thought for me. I asked you at the beginning if you were familiar with VORP. I used to be a volunteer for Victim Offender. My quick question is this: whether or not we raise this fee or not, can you just briefly state from your three counties how much can we depend on or even search for more partnerships outside of government that could be helpful, whether they're religious or secular, but counseling services that are nonprofit to help with the workload that you, I mean, are we reaching out to bring the cost down and increase our ability to meet the needs of mediation and conciliatory services?
So, Representative Gilliam, there are some very specific requirements for mediators to be qualified to do this work that are set out by the Chief Justice of Oregon in, I think it's Chief Justice Rule 05028. I have to refer to it often enough that I remember it. So it is difficult to reach out to nonprofits or other entities to provide this particular service because the requirements for training and qualifications are very stringent. And of course, as a mediator, I'm going to support that. I know the sensitivity of the situations we work with. I understand how important it is for mediators to know something about court proceedings and divorce and child development and domestic violence and substance abuse and all those kinds of issues. So that is complicated. What I can say is that I believe and I'm aware of efforts that all of the programs have made to reach out for additional funding in other ways. Nobody has been sitting on their heels hoping for more to sort of happen for them. I've applied for several grants successfully. We do some things in-house to try to build revenue. My county has stepped up with some county general fund because it has the resources to do so. But that can't continue. At some point, this was a very specific mandated service established by an act of the legislature, and at some point, I feel strongly that the way it's funded needs to be looked at and addressed. And at the same time, we're working very hard to continue to provide services. A lot of that additional revenue comes with additional work, so it can be a bit of a catch-22.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the testimony is very eloquent, and I'm reminded of the 15 years or so that I spent working as a forensic psychologist, and a big chunk of my practice was in conducting custody evaluations in cases in which parents were utterly unable to make a parenting plan. So the testimony that we've heard today reminds me of those years and of the successes and failures that I had in conducting evaluations and making recommendations to the court. When I started in 1984, 1985, doing that work, there were no mediation programs. The mediation wasn't even thought of as a specialized skill at that point. The programs to teach mediation developed during the time of my practice, some done by lawyers, some done by mental health professionals. I was self-taught in a way because there were only a couple of books on the subject in 1984. Gardner's book from New Jersey, which I'm sure you know about, and others, a couple of others. Fortunately, with my background as a lawyer and as a very well-trained psychologist with background in testing and assessment, I was able to piece together the realities of a lot of cases in which parents were abusing kids, but it was hard to prove what was going on exactly, and so forth. And those services were very, very important to those children when I got it right, and they would have been important to them if I had gotten it right in the cases I didn't. We are dealing with a situation in a life of a family when doing it right means taking the pieces on the floor and putting them back together in a new way that is not the same as the old way, but that potentially might work even better than the old way did for the family. And I say the family because parents and children, of course, are still connected to each other, even if they're living in different households and married to different spouses and spend their time partly with one parent and partly with the other. They're still connected to each other in ways that they cannot do anything about for the rest of their lives. It's the way it is. Doing it right at a time when they are teachable, when it's possible to change the outcomes, which is the case when the marriage has finally come apart, people have acknowledged that it's come apart, and it's now time to do something different. And what is that different thing? Really, really important. The programs that allow for mediation in the counties, in the court systems, are critically important to getting to that next stage right there at that nexus point. Right there when, in the next few months, everything is going to change. And what is it going to look like? And what are our attitudes going to be? And how are we going to proceed? And what are the skills that we need in order to do that? You cannot replace that kind of service. It is critically important for those families at that moment. It requires the specialized training and attitude that has been described to us. I never did mediation because it was a different program, different skill than the one that I brought to the table. But I certainly understood how important it is. And in the cases where it works, you have families that settle down, that don't fight anymore, that work out the day-to-day interactions with the children and the parents. They figure out ways that they can ally with each other, where the parents can ally with each other to the benefit of the children as they grow up, as married parents do, parents who stay together do in successful relationships and with children who grow up well. And the key to being able to do that is having systems in place that allow for the kind of work that's been described to us today. I don't know that this method of funding this service is the best way or necessarily the right way to go, but that this service is critically important to those families at that time, there is no question at all in my mind. And, Madam Chair, we need to figure out a way to make sure that it gets done, that we have skilled people doing the work, that there are enough of them to actually spend the time on each family that needs that time to get it done. And I'm not sure this is the right approach, but I will take this approach over no approach if that's what our choice is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other comments? Okay, with that, I would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 3418. And we will not be meeting on Wednesday or Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And happy National Puppy Day.